Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
No job in American policing as tough as being a cop in Los Angeles. I'm incredibly proud of the work that you do, and I believe that you do it to a standard that is absolutely unequaled in our profession. You have my support. You have the support of the mayor. You have the support of the vast majority of the people of Los Angeles. Build on that support. Police constitutionally. Do things right and do them in the right way, and we will continue to have that support, and that support is what will protect you, just like the vest you're wearing protects you, and just like your partner watches your back.
That's Police Chief Charlie Beck talking to the LAPD rank and file. It's a video he released last month, right after the police commission found the officers were not justified in shooting Ezell Ford. Today, in the latest installment of our Making LA series, we talk about policing in Los Angeles.
L.A., of course, is the kind of temporary city.
The punk rock attitude of L.A.
Los Angeles is a desert community.
We used to build things in the San Fernando Valley.
What would it mean for downtown to work?
L.A. is not a pretty city except from the air.
City of tomorrow.
Making L.A. is our series on what we can do to make our city a better place. The LAPD has received a lot of praise for reducing crime and improving relations with minority communities. But so far this year, crime is up, in some cases by double digits. And the national conversation about police shootings, particularly of minorities, has also touched Los Angeles. And so far this year, L.A. police have shot 21 people. That's nearly one a week. Joining me now to talk about policing in Los Angeles are Jim Newton, editor of a new UCLA magazine. It's called Blueprint. He's also a former longtime editor and reporter at the LA Times, where he covered the LAPD. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Skip Townsend is here. He's head of Second Call. That's a gang intervention organization in South LA. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, first, let's talk about this increase in crime statistics. We have major crime up 13% from last year, including a 26% increase in aggravated assault. We should note that homicides are down about 6.5%, though. But to what do you attribute this overall increase, Skip?
I think the overall increase is a number of things. I think number one is the emotions of the young people in the community. They handle every situation with anger, with violence. So I think number two is the fact that there's not a lot of resources, so individuals take opportunities to break into people's houses, whether they're home or not. So I think it's being opportunistic and not having the resources. I think lack of education is number one as well, but I think it's an overall. I don't think it's just one thing. I think it's a combination of many, and that's going on in the communities
right
now.
And gang activity apparently is up too. Does that
contribute? I wouldn't say gang activity, but what a lot of people don't realize is during the summer months, they are what they call hood days, where individuals gather and a lot of funerals. So there's a lot of emotions tied to being around individuals during times of funerals, during times of trauma, as they experience trauma with one another. So it kind of leads to be violent activities.
Jim, what do you think?
Well, I certainly agree with all of that. On top of that, I think there's some question about whether Prop 47, which has reduced some felonies to misdemeanors and therefore put some people back on the street, whether that may be contributing to some increase that's relatively new. You know, and then there's a question of how productive the police department's being, whether it's doing its job well. So I think those are all potential factors. I think it's safe to say from the mayor, the press conference that the mayor and the chief had the other day, that they're not really confident about what's going on. I think it's important that they get to the bottom of it. That's be the first step toward turning this around.
Do you think, I mean, there is a theory that I've read that because of the increased scrutiny over police and police shootings that has happened in the last year, that police have kind of held back? And that might be a part of it?
There certainly is some historic precedent for that. Back when I covered the police department, it was known as driving and waving, where they would not engage in proactive policing. Arrests dropped rather dramatically. And with it, we saw some unsettling things with respect to crime. Whether that's happening right now, I don't know. There was a little talk of that in the wake of the Ezell Ford decision, whether police would cause them to pull back and be reticent. I don't think that could be really playing into these numbers very much, because these numbers cover a 6-month period, and that's just in the last few weeks. But that's always something to keep to monitor at the police department for sure.
Skip, do you think that has an effect?
I really don't. And then I want to say something about Prop 47, where they reduced a number of felonies to misdemeanors. It was based on a number, based on $1,000. If the crimes that were committed had a value of over $1,000, then it was reduced.
Shoplifting.
Right. So I really don't think, these aren't violent offenders. We're not talking about murders and rapists and things of this nature. We're talking about mostly white-collar crimes, or I don't want to say white-collar because, like you say, it's shoplifting or things of that nature, but they're not the violent offenders. So when violence goes up, I want to attribute that to the violent offenders and not the individuals who were really wasting taxpayer dollars, spending 20 years in prison just because it was their third felony or
right.
something of that nature.
And we should note also that these statistics are similar in other big cities like New York and Chicago, that violent crime is up.
There's another long-term issue here that people have talked about for a long time, which is just demographics. There's been a historically fairly low number of 18 to 25-year-old men in the population over the last 15, 20 years. That is the group of people that commit the most crimes in the United States. That number may be starting to come back up again, too. So we may be seeing something that is really broadly demographic and sort of beyond the control in certain ways of some of these various measures.
All right. So that brings me to the overall question of policing and what tactics the police should use. And we've heard a lot about broken windows. It's something that Bill Bratton brought with him from New York when he became police commissioner here in Los Angeles in 2002, mm-hmm. I believe. And that was credited with a large reduction in crime. Do you think too much credit was given to this broken windows idea, which is the broad idea being that you crack down on small crimes and that will reduce large crimes?
I do want to take away from all of that. Chief Bratton, great individual, but I believe that he was forced by the dissent decree. I believe that those were the things that made him take action, because there was an oversight. What we don't have here in L.A. now is that oversight. Even though we have the commission and the board that runs the commission, but there is the bottom line is based on Chief Charlie Beck and what he decides for his punishment for those officers. So when you don't have an outside agency, when you don't have that outside force looking over, then individuals are there to police themselves. So I really don't think it was the broken windows approach. I think it was a number thing. And one of the things that I can give credit for with Chief Bratton is the fact that he helped the cream rise to the top in LAPD. He helped promote the Chief Becks and the Chief Gardeners and other people. So he saw the people who were in touch with the community, and he brought them to the forefront, which led to better community relations.
You've done a lot of research into broken windows, Jim. What do you think about that and its effect on crime?
I think broken windows, as applied by smart police departments, has had a dramatic effect on the levels of crime in their communities. I think some police departments apply it ham-handedly, and they have come to believe that what broken windows stands for is the idea of zero tolerance.
And stop and frisk.
Right. And stop and frisk. And right. I think that's a real misconstruction of what James K. Wilson was writing about. Really what he was writing about is how community decay and disrepair creates an environment in which crime flourishes. And so if you're able to single out low-level offenders and causes of quality of life decay in communities and improve those things and make those arrests, that has the effect of causing violent crime and more serious crime to decline as well.
But what is that effect? Is that effect that you have locked up people who would be committing these crimes, or is it
that's
that
the Prop 40? Those are the ones who are eligible for Prop 47. Those broken windows. So we haven't changed the mindset or the behavior of the individuals. We've just actually put them in jail. So that's why I don't believe it actually helps.
But is there evidence that people who, let's say, graffiti, if they're not caught and punished, that then they go on to commit greater crimes?
Well, for instance,
or they're two separate
sort of classic
cohorts.
Example of this is outstanding gun warrants. If police serve warrants and collect people who have a violent offense and pull them in on that warrant, relatively minor offense, a warrant violation, you will often see a decrease in violent crime because those people are likely to commit violent crimes too.
Or is that just getting a gun off the streets?
No,
well,
that's getting
a criminal off the street, a criminal with a gun off the street.
Right, so now I agree with that one. I mean, if there's gun warrants, that's not minor to me.
That's
major.
Different than graffiti and shoplifting.
That's different than the graffiti and the shoplifting.
Smoking
so
weed.
That's something that I would support.
And I would say, too, the point of community sort of quality of life is really not just a police department function. Really, what part of what Wilson was writing about is the need for urban areas to concentrate on blight, to eliminate blight, and because in that environment, people feel more willing to commit crime. And so there is this is not just a police department phenomenon. It really is an urban phenomenon, and it's something that I do think that Wilson's theory, as I said, when well applied by intelligent police departments and intelligent cities, has had a dramatic effect.
Well, now that it has been called in question because it has led to stop and frisk, which a lot of people are saying is obviously not a good thing and led to, for instance, Eric Garner death in Staten Island. So that whole theory, is it being thrown out? And is there any new theory that police are now trying to adopt?
As I said, when police departments thought this through well and translated it into a constructive community policing model, problem solving, engaging with community, and also arresting certain kinds of offenders who might commit other crimes. That's an intelligent blend. Stop and frisk is just a blunt instrument and unconstitutional probably at that. So that is not an intelligent application of broken windows and ought to be stopped and in most places I think is stopped.
Yeah. And Skip, I understand that you actually work with LAPD officers and try to train them in community policing.
I'm glad you put try in there.
Right. What is the biggest obstacle then?
Well, the biggest obstacle is to get them to even want to sit there and listen. You know, we're often training LAPD in there with the sheriff department or other agencies, and we notice that they don't even sit together. They don't communicate with each other, so they definitely don't want to communicate with us. Maybe 30 minutes into the training, they learn who we are, our backgrounds, and it kind of throws them for a loop. But there are different exercises that force us to sit at the table and work together on situations that happen in the community, and it kind of opens their eyes. It gives them a different look at intervention, but the problem comes is that we deal with each other maybe 3 or 4 times a year. Hmm. You know, there are 10,000 sworn officers, so every time there's a shooting or every time there's an incident at a school and we respond, we're not always responding with the same officers. So as we build these relationships, they want to promote. And as they promote, they get transferred to another division and they're gone to the Valley or they're gone to Central Division and they're not in South where, you know, for our entire lives, we're there.
Yeah.
We're in South LA, so it's just about rebuilding the relationships and starting over from scratch, you know. And that's one of the most difficult challenges. If I can say something about the theory of broken windows, it's for me a good theory, but I think the wrong part of it is to make an arrest. The lower level crimes. These are individuals who need help, and we have a lot of mentally challenged people, and we also have a lot of homeless people. So with this population, there are resources that are needed. So instead of arresting someone and taking them to jail, and some of these low-level offenses, they get 6 months, even a year. But where do they return to 6 months later, a year later? That is the part. It's like putting a Band-Aid on a situation that really needs major surgery.
And how effective is community policing these days? I mean, we saw a big change from the old Daryl Gates way of patrolling a neighborhood, which was mainly from a car and just flooding the zone in a very militaristic approach. And then Chief Bratton came along and implemented CompStat, which was a statistical model to find out where to concentrate your resources. And there was the consent decree, Skip, as you mentioned, which focused more on community policing. So where are we now with that?
Well, I believe that we have come a long way since Daryl Gates. There are officers in South Bureau who are designated to deal with gang intervention. That is their job every day, is to reach out to gang intervention and see what the hot spots, what resources are needed, what can they do. We often talk at ceasefire meetings, also the Watch Gang Task Force. So there's a number of officers who have relationships. There's one commander now in South LA who was, I mean, just the ultimate captain. He was one of the guys that Christopher Dorner was actually chasing around. And he could have went into any one of those projects and they would have protected him.
Wow.
That's the beauty of the relationships now. However, what happens is when Chief Beck makes a statement stating to the officers that he supports them in the wake of the Ezell Ford shooting, that sends us back about 10 years. When Craig Lally, the president of the union, makes a statement that, well, this was a gang member and he lived in a gang neighborhood. Well, when you start identifying our communities as gang neighborhoods, these are communities where we live. A lot of times, simply because our grandmothers lived there, that our mothers lived there and raised us there. So when you start degrading our culture and our neighborhoods, once again, it becomes us against them. So,
and Jim, you've talked to Chief Beck recently. Is he aware of this? Does he have this kind of sensitivity?
Yeah, listen. I mean, Chief Beck has seen the police department that Daryl Gates ran, and he's seen the police department that Bill Bratton ran, and others, Chief Parks and others in between. I don't think there's any question but that he's a person of good conscience, that he's a smart police officer, that he has really learned the lessons and the benefits of community policing. Is he perfect? No. And are these issues ever permanently solved? Also, no. I actually did an interview with him for our magazine a while back, and one of the things he talked about is the difficulty of maintaining public trust. It is never something that's possible to take for granted because it is always really just one shooting away from unraveling on you.
But does he realize, we played that tape at the top of the show, that tape of him praising the rank and file after the Ezell Ford decision by the commission. Does he realize what that sounds like on the ground?
That's a good question. I haven't talked to him since then, so I don't know how he's reacting to the kinds of criticisms that you're making, Skip.
Right. So is there still overall a feeling, Skip, of distrust between the community in South L.A.?
Yeah, you have different relationships. People like myself, the interventionist, we have beautiful relationships with the commanders, the deputy chiefs. Makes a big difference. But when you talk about the average individual in the community, they don't trust law enforcement, and they have every reason not to. There was a young man who was killed. March 13th, Leroy Hill was killed on 65th and Broadway. He was the witness to the Ezell Ford shooting. And 2 days after that, there was officer-involved shooting on the same street that shut the street down for 48 hours. And there was a major investigation. Undercover officers riding down the street with L.A. Dodger hats on. So they appeared to be the Latino community coming to shoot the African-Americans. But actually, they were undercover officers. So there's a major distrust, and, you know, the captain of that area, George Rodriguez, he's very good at walking up and down the street, so he's trying to rebuild that trust. And, you know, for people my age, I'm 50, so we can kind of build the trust, but the 20-year-olds, they're like, they don't want to talk. They don't want to hear it.
All right, we'll have to end it there. I want to thank you both for coming in today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Skip Townsend, head of Second Call, a gang intervention organization in South LA, and Jim Newton, editor of a new UCLA magazine. It's called Blueprint. And we want to hear from you. How are the police doing in your neighborhood? Do you have suggestions for how policing could be improved? Check in with us on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how a case in Los Angeles over campus sexual assault could affect cases nationwide. A judge found that UC San Diego should not have suspended a student accused of assaulting a female student. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Rape can happen anywhere. For me, I was raped in my own dorm bed. And since then, that space has become fraught for me. And I feel like I've carried the weight of what happened there with me everywhere.
Former Columbia University student Emma Sulkowicz, she carried a mattress around campus to protest how the school handled her rape complaint. Sulkowicz is one of many women who helped bring a spotlight to the issue of campus sexual assault. Now, though, the conversation is shifting a bit to the people accused. Are schools trampling on their rights to a fair trial? A Los Angeles Superior Court judge this week ruled that UC San Diego did just that to one male student accused of rape. The ruling could have big implications for similar cases across the country. Casey Johnson is co-author of the book Until Proven Innocent, Political Correctness and the Shameful Injustices of the Duke LaCrosse Rape Case, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I understand you read the case file in this San Diego case. And so what does the judge say, and what do you think of his ruling?
The judge's argument was it was a clear ruling. I think it was a correct ruling. And his basic argument was that UC San Diego's process was so unfair that the result that it produced, which was a finding that the accused student had committed sexual assault, simply can't be trusted. There were a whole variety of errors that the university made, from denying the accuser the right to an attorney to preventing the accused student from asking questions of the accuser, who was the only witness in the hearing. And the judge basically said, look, since we can't trust this, we need someone to step in, and Judge Pressman took that role.
So it wasn't on the merits of the accusation per se, but on how the university handled it.
Correct. Although, you know, reading between the lines of the judge's opinion, he was skeptical about the merits of the accusation as well. It was a complicated case where the accuser had initially claimed two instances of sexual misconduct. UC San Diego's own investigation said that there was no evidence of the first, but didn't allow that non-credible allegation to be used to address the second claim. But it was primarily a procedural point. The phrase that he used was a fundamental unfairness in the approach that the university used.
Isn't it rare, though, for these kinds of cases to make it to court outside the university system in the first place?
It is. There's a longstanding and really quite understandable bias that courts don't like to second-guess universities, because traditionally university disciplinary processes deal with things like plagiarism or academic misconduct. And these are areas, quite frankly, where academics know the rules much better than a judge does. And courts basically say, look, we don't want to get involved. What we're dealing with now, I think, that was quite different. I mean, since 2011, there's been very strong pressure applied by the federal government for universities to investigate and adjudicate sexual assault claims. Sexual assault is a crime. It's a very serious crime. And there's no reason why universities should be better able to handle that than the court system. And in fact, there are lots of reasons to think that universities are less well-equipped to handle it. So one of the things that we're seeing in both state and federal courts, and there have been a variety of decisions on both sides around the country in the last couple of years, is an attempt to figure out what is the proper role for the courts in overseeing university actions when the allegation is a criminal allegation. Student who was convicted doesn't go to jail, but this would be a mark that stayed with him for his entire life if it were not removed from the transcript.
Right. Well, I guess the first step would be to actually report the cases that are reported to the university, which many universies were found in violation of the Title IX.
Correct. I mean, I think that there needs to be a much closer relationship between universities and law enforcement, and trying to find ways essentially to encourage a greater law enforcement role on campus. Obviously, you know, a complainant in sexual assault can't be required to report a crime, but there seems to be a lot of distrust between law enforcement and the university communities, and hopefully universities can do a better job at stimulating dialogue between the two sides.
So there has been a lot of focus on the universities letting accusers off the hook, or if not following through on accusations, or not even investigating in the first place. Do you think that we're seeing a swing in the pendulum going too far in the other direction?
Yeah, there seems to be a pretty significant swing. And frankly, and put yourself in the position of a university. The administration is threatening, in a worst-case scenario, to withhold federal funds if universities aren't aggressive enough in both investigating and adjudicating these cases. And so, you know, from the standpoint of a university, in a case like the San Diego case, the worst-case scenario is, look, you basically falsely convict a guy, he'll sue, maybe he'll win, maybe he'll lose, but the federal government won't become involved. And it's also worth remembering, in most university cases, if a student who is accused of sexual assault doesn't have a right to counsel, he doesn't have a right to discover the evidence that the university has compiled against him. So a lot of the basic due process protections that all of us assume exist in the criminal justice system to ensure a fair outcome don't exist in the university system. It's a system that was designed to handle academic misconduct that's now being applied to criminal misconduct, and I'm not sure that it fits particularly well for that purpose.
Yeah, but although there have been a lot of accusations that universities have done the exact same thing, but against the accuser, in other words, not following through on accusations, not pursuing evidence, and just letting the accuser off the hook.
There have been a lot of these allegations in the last couple of years. Generally, they've been conduct allegations. The argument has been that the universities haven't aggressively investigated. There have been very few allegations, I'm actually not aware of any, where the argument has been made that the university procedure itself is unfair to the accuser. It'd be very difficult to make that argument because the structure of the procedures at all universities, and this is on all conduct issues, not just sexual assault, are designed really in such a way that they tilt towards the university making the complaint.
Well, that is if they pursue it, right?
Correct, correct, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the complaint has been that they haven't even bothered to pursue it.
That's correct, and I think that there has been a general presumption, and this has changed since 2011. The administration issued this this guideline that criminal offenses are not terribly well suited to deal with in the university process. The administration has now made clear to all universities that this issue alone, I mean, murder, for instance, or attempted murder isn't handled through the university process. That universities must handle this. So that change, I think, has now been accepted by universities across the board, and as we move forward, it's going to be less and less likely that we won't see universities investigate these episodes. And so my guess is we'll see more and more episodes like the San Diego case, and the question is what role will the courts pursue in sort of overseeing the issue? And that question is unanswered right now.
Casey Johnson, co-author of the book Until Proven Innocent, Political Correctness and the Shameful Injustices of the Duke Lacrosse Rape Case. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, have you had any experiences involving campus sexual assault? What do you think schools could be doing better? Do you think that this needs to be handled by the criminal justice system? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why do some gay men have a certain way of speaking? And how will America's acceptance of gays and lesbians affect the way we talk?
I think if anything, America's voices are going to get gayer.
I'll speak with the director of the new documentary, Do I Sound Gay? After a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Tim Gunn is one of my favorite TV personalities.
Every time I say disparaging things about Crocs, their stock goes up, they open a new store. I don't know what it is, but someone made me put them on once. I admit that they're comfortable, but I looked down at my foot and I thought, I have a hoof.
No one, including Tim Gunn himself, would deny that he, quote unquote, sounds gay. But what exactly does that mean? A new documentary explores the stereotype of the gay voice. It's called...
Do I Sound Gay?
Yes, I think you do sound gay. Not as much as I do, but...
Yes. Yes.
No. En français, no. In English, I don't know.
Yes.
Not at all.
Really?
That's David Thorpe, the director of Do I Sound Gay? And he's with me in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
Joining us also, Dan Savage, one of the people David interviews in his documentary. Dan is an activist who created the It Gets Better campaign, and he writes the syndicated column Savage Love. He's in Seattle. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, do gay men really talk about this? Is this something that they talk about? Do I sound gay?
No. I mean, I think one reason that people are so interested in Do I Sound Gay is because... as one of my friends in the film says, it's an elephant in the room. And, you know, the film kind of goes into why that is. And there's a lot of complicating shame and fear of effeminacy and all those kind of things that have kind of contributed to our silence about our voices.
And Dan, talk about that history of sounding gay or trying not to sound gay when it comes to being public and being out.
Well, David's film goes into the history of sounding gay, and he might be better at addressing that. I do know, because I hear about it all the time in my sex advice column, that a lot of gay men have this anxiety about how perceptibly gay they are, whether they look gay, act gay, walk gay, talk gay. And I've always felt that it was kind of a hangover from adolescence when you were lived in terror of anybody being able to tell you were gay, because that could mean homelessness if your parents threw you out. It could mean violence from your peers, rejection. And there was this, you know, there were these colossal potential consequences to your voice betraying you and outing you. And then once you come out, a lot of people then realize that there are social consequences, even in gay land, about your voice betraying you, that there is this value placed on masculinity, and people who suppressed their natural, I think natural, gayish sounding voices in adolescence sort of learn to re-suppress them when they first come out and they, you know, enter the dating scene, because it makes you less sexually desirable in some circles, which I don't understand. I don't say that like I agree with it. I like guys who are gay. I like guys who look gay and talk gay and act gay and walk gay. I actually find it really attractive when someone is obviously and really very, very gay. I watch Project One Runway and RuPaul's Drag Race to ogle the goods.
But, you know, Dan, you don't sound gay in the stereotypical way.
I have my moments. And I guess my voice doesn't portray me as particularly gay, but my mannerisms do, my interests do, and I have no self-consciousness about it. I'm a big musical theater queen, and I let myself be myself. And I have feminine traits and masculine traits, and some people say my voice is kind of masculine. Some people say I have a lisp, that my S's are a little sloppy and broad. But I literally don't give a word I'm not allowed to say on NPR about it.
But David, you had some shame about this, and this is, I guess, what propelled you on your journey. And you visit a couple of speech experts who try to teach you how not to sound gay. And where did that shame come from?
Well, I think it's exactly as Dan said. You know, when I was in middle school in the early 80s, I was bullied for being effeminate and quickly learned to fit in and pass as straight. You know, when I came out, I defiantly embraced everything gay. You know, I tried to dress more flamboyantly, and that also included my voice. And in the film, my friends and family tell me that after I came out, I suddenly, quote, sounded gay. But the problem is, not everybody who comes out of the closet snaps his or her fingers and leaves behind those messages that we get as kids. And so I've been haunted for a lot of my life with these kind of ghosts of shame. And as Dan said, you know, our voices, quote, betray us when sometimes we're not feeling confident about who we are.
Okay, so the question that you tried to answer is, where does this come from? Is this nature or nurture? Is this something that you pick up, or is this something that you're born with?
Well, the movie puts forth two of the main theories, that there's a childhood language acquisition component, and then there's also an adult component of, you know, your peer group having an influence on you. You know, there's not a lot of money being thrown at this topic, so the research is not widespread. But both those theories hold water for me. I mean, I think there are aspects of nature and nurture in our voices.
And there is definitely a cadence, a specific cadence. It involves longer vowels.
Well, in the stereotype of the gay voice, which is that, you know, you sound more like a woman, it is true that some men adopt these speech patterns that are more typical of women. So it is true that women are generally more articulate when they speak, and that includes a very distinctive sibilant S, and that of course is a signature of the so-called gay voice. And so there are these small differences between the way men and women typically speak that are sort of making people read as gay or as straight.
And Dan, when it comes to the gay world and having a typical gay voice, I mean, I wonder if you could talk more about that in terms of sexual attractiveness and what it signals to people in the gay world.
It signals that you're not a bro, that you're not a dude, that you may have feminine traits, and feminine traits are so stigmatized. And I really think, you know, what undergirds a lot of this sort of prejudice and policing for non-masculine traits, even among gay men, is misogyny, that to be feminine is to be less than and to be less valued and less respected and less desirable. And I think that, you know, you see that in men too, you see that in straight men too, and it's, you know, straight men policing each other for evidence of anything that isn't sort of masculine or male approved or a male typical interest. And it's exhausting and pointless. And, you know, I find it distressing when gay people embrace those same cultural assumptions, those same prejudices that are used to used against us, that are used to discriminate against us, to justify anti-gay hatred and discrimination and violence. But it just seems as each successive wave of gay men come out, they have to, that brand new wave of just out gay guys have to get over the misogyny, the internalized homophobia, racism, transphobia, other stuff that the other older gay men have already worked through and processed and overcome if they were struggling with those issues and that kind of prejudice or those kinds of prejudices.
Well, it's interesting that, David, you feature young people in your movie who don't care. And they're really popular on YouTube and they sound very, very gay and they love it and they're embracing it. And they have lots of millions of followers on YouTube and the like. That now it's become the reverse, that having a gay voice is something that people are you know, feel proud of and are honoring and are brandishing.
I think for sure the YouTube generation has embraced their individuality, and that includes boys who sound gay or sound effeminate, whether or not they are gay. And, you know, when I was growing up, somebody like Tyler Oakley could never have had 5 or 6 million YouTube followers.
Okay, so here is what happened. I was just at Chipotle, which was my first mistake, because why should I be leaving the house? This is what happens when you leave home. Things happen.
He would have been a pariah. And it's really heartening to see that the straight tweens that I know love Tyler Oakley, and they don't see anything unusual about him. They don't see him as a gay guy. They see him as Tyler Oakley. That said, of course, there are teens who are in homes where their parents reject them or are in communities where they can't possibly come out and are still facing abuse, violence, harassment. So, you know, things are certainly looking much, much better, but I think it will be a long time before what happened at the Supreme Court earlier this summer changes everybody's lives. It's funny, I was talking to somebody today who told me that he was watching his wedding video and he was cringing at how gay he sounded. And I thought, isn't that a perfect little anecdote? Because just because he was granted the right to get married to his husband didn't make him any less self-conscious about sounding gay.
And Dan, you know, considering your Gets Better campaign, is this something that it's different in the middle of the country than it is perhaps in the coasts, in LA, in New York, maybe Seattle, where it's okay to come out and to sound gay, but elsewhere it is not? I mean, do you see the difference in places where it's maybe not?
I think it's less consequential, less potentially ruinous, and less risky to sound gay in a Seattle or a San Francisco than it is in you know, Texas or Alabama. But I don't necessarily think it's always easier. I think there are spaces and areas and communities. And you see people who are gay put on their straight voice and put on their gay voice. You see people turn it on and off. Code switch is the term of art that people use. And it's not just African-Americans that engage in that kind of code switching. It's also gay people engage in that kind of code switching. And gay people include some African-Americans, of course. That, you know, if you're in a truck stop in Alabama, you may butch up that voice so as not to attract unwelcome attention. I know when I was a kid and I would leave the house and hang out with my gay friends, I sounded very differently at 18 years old with my gay friends than I would allow myself to sound when I was talking to my straight parents that I was not yet out to.
You know, I was thinking, I've been doing a lot of interviews, and I realize it's easier for me to come in and talk to you, Madeline, about sounding gay than it is for me to come out to the guy who drove me to the airport. Because I don't know what he thinks of gay people, and I don't know how he'll react.
Do you put on a different voice?
And I think sometimes I code switch and I unconsciously butch it up because...
Because you don't want any grief.
You don't want any grief. And, you know, depending on the circumstances you come from, you know how much grief is out there. And I just think that's so interesting that I could tell all of Southern California I'm gay, you know, and... this and that about myself, but when it comes to interacting with a total stranger, that's actually scarier.
Yeah. Well, you talk in the film about how you didn't have a gay voice when you were a child, and that having a gay voice is also being part of a tribe of power, of strength and numbers. So when you moved to New York, you wanted to join this tribe and adopt its mores.
Yeah, I have had a lot of times in my life when I loved being gay, and my voice was part of that. And I have a theatrical group of friends, and we did crazy gender bending stuff together. And that was a really exciting, fun time where I was able to kind of embrace my sissy. But, you know, life is not a linear experience, and there are things that knock the wind out of you. And this project began when I felt like that's exactly what had happened. I was kind of really at an impasse in terms of accepting myself and my voice.
Well, I wonder, though, if, you know, as gay people become more accepted, gay marriage is, you know, it's the law of the land as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, if the voice will go away.
I think if anything, America's voices are going to get gayer. I mean, what you're talking about is that more and more we have a place at the table and we don't have to be afraid to be ourselves. And, you know, you may have a lot of guys who aren't gay sounding a lot gayer because they feel free to be who they are. So, you know, there was a time when I thought the so-called gay voice was a product of the closet, and I think it's quite the opposite. And I think this is actually one of the things Dan said to me very early on, which is, you know, maybe this is your real voice. Maybe it's not. Maybe you haven't just embraced a stereotype. Maybe this is a voice you identify with and expresses something about you. But it's hard to embrace that voice sometimes when it's so contrary to what's conventional.
Well, I want to thank you both very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
It's been great hearing your voices. David Thorpe, director of the new documentary, Do I Sound Gay? Dan Savage is one of the subjects of his movie. Do I Sound Gay also features interviews with Tim Gunn, David Sedaris, George Takei, and Margaret Cho. And it opens at the Sundance Sunset Cinemas in West Hollywood this Friday. And I also talked to David Thorpe and Dan Savage about women's voices. You can hear that conversation on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, Warren Olney, what kind of voices are we going to hear at 1 o'clock?
Time for my voice. Well, we're going to hear about the sharing economy, the gig economy, it's also called, and how full-time jobs are becoming part-time gigs and what that means for the relationships between employers and employees. And it really does. It's becoming very pervasive. Uber is only the biggest example of it. And in fact, it's really going to change the way we do things. And it's got a lot of implications for worker protections and how you pay taxes and whether there should be government regulations.
Whether or not you have time in the middle of the day to listen to KCRW.
That's also true. Yeah, well, maybe you do. Even so if you have 10 gigs a week. There are people that have 10 gigs a week. Imagine trying to stay alive on 10 gigs a week.
No.
We'll see.
Okay. Look forward to that.
It's good stuff.
At 1 o'clock, coming up before that, mindfulness as capitalist tool, why companies are saying yes to OM, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Mother, son, we greet you. The new day brings new hope, new ideas, a new you.
And with that, Cliffside Meditation at Big Sur, Mad Men ended, and Don Draper was back in business. He used his enlightenment experience to make the perfect Coke commercial. Well, today, you don't need to trek out to Esalen to reap the benefits of meditation because, well...
Say hello to Headspace.
There is an app for that.
You'll get access to hundreds of hours of original Headspace content, including guided and unguided exercises from 2 minutes to an hour. That's a whole lot of mindfulness.
Mindfulness mania is sweeping the business world, with hedge fund managers extolling its benefits and companies from General Motors to Goldman Sachs offering meditation packages for their employees. But some people are offended by this McMindfulness, calling it a capitalist perversion of what should be a spiritual practice. Joining me to discuss this is David McMahon. He's religious studies professor at Franklin and Marshall College and author of the book, The Making of Buddhist Modernism. Let's talk about these mindfulness apps. Headspace, as we heard at the top, is one of them, but there are many of them. What do you think of these apps? I mean, why not clear your head for, I don't know, 10 minutes a day?
Well, I think there's no reason whatsoever why you shouldn't clear your head for 10 minutes a day. And I think
that's a good thing to do no matter what you're doing. I think the controversy comes in the sort of dilemma regarding whether these practices are really for the benefit of employees and whether they're being done for the good of employees, or whether they're kind of a top-down thing that managers will impose on people that might actually make them sort of feel like if there's a problem at work, or if there's a some kind of unmanageable workplace environment or unmanageable hours being asked of the employees, that's just kind of your problem and you can deal with it through a clearer mind with meditation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, could you have it both ways, that you're helping the bottom line and helping the wellness of the particular employee?
I think it is possible. I mean, there are a lot of people who believe that if these practices become more widespread in companies, that they may actually serve to sort of transform organizations from the bottom up and make employees more critical, not only of their own thoughts and minds, but also of the organization more generally.
Or of the entire enterprise, because isn't the essential philosophy anti-materialistic?
Well, exactly. And I think that's another important thing, is that these practices never have been taught in a vacuum. And so this is a new thing. The irony, I guess, is that the folks who invented these practices really rejected their mainstream culture, and now they're being used to adapt to and to succeed in our mainstream culture, and now they're being used in some of the most influential secular organizations like the military and corporations and universities and so on.
Have you ever tried one of these apps?
I've not tried the apps. I've meditated quite a bit in my life, but I haven't tried the apps yet.
Well, so when you're meditating for real, I imagine a true deep meditation takes longer than 10 minutes.
It does, I think. And, if in some context, if you would go to a monastery and say, well, I want to learn meditation, well, you would learn it as a part of a bigger package, a whole philosophical view and with ethics and values and attitudes. And so that's another one of the potential problems with meditation being taught stripped of all that, is that it becomes a kind of valueless exercise that can be adopted to almost any end.
But do you think it's actually affecting real Buddhism and people who practice it for real?
I don't think it has much effect on real Buddhism, and I think there's a lot of ambivalence in the Buddhist community about it, too. I wouldn't say there's a kind of outright rejection of this. Some people would say, this is a little bit of good that can be filtered into otherwise toxic environments of corporate America, and they don't have a problem with it. Some people, though, think that it's too stripped down and too utilitarian, too prone to be used for goals that are antithetical to the Buddhist path, which is fundamentally about overcoming, what they call the three poisons: greed, hatred, and ignorance.
So that is pretty ironic, at least in the first instance.
Exactly. If it's being used to foster greed and to, just generate more money for hedge fund managers.
Right. And so is this actually something that people in your profession who study religions, is something that people are really worried about?
Well, I think it's something they find fascinating, in that, historians of religion like myself are really interested in seeing the transformations of religion historically. And I think this is a really significant moment in the long, almost 3,000-year-old history of meditation practices coming from India and Asia. The fact that they've been so widespread and are present in so many different kinds of organizations now really is a very new thing.
And so do you have any tips if let's say someone wants to get into this, what they should do?
Well, I would try to find a good teacher and not think that you're going to master meditation in 10 minutes. Probably most people, the first time they meditate, they just think they're insane because they realize they can't control their mind at all. And, it can be a negative experience. So I think it takes time, and that's another thing that I think people should be a little cautious about, is promises of some kind of miraculous, quick transformation that's going to just fix everything in your life.
But that's the American way.
Exactly.
David McMahon, religious studies professor at Franklin and Marshall College and author of The Making of Buddhist Modernism. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Shanti, Joey Myers.
Hello. Hello, Madeline. So I know what happened at the beginning of that interview. He was practicing deep mindfulness and missed his cue.
That must have been it.
I mean, come on. This is Meta Radio here.
Maybe our engineer was.
Yeah, everybody, mindfulness. So we talked about the film Do I Sound Gay on the show today. We wanted to know if our listeners had ever changed the way they talk to fit in better. Elizabeth Ponce was not feeling it. She says on Facebook that to just focus on sounding gay seems like missing the fact that people change the way they speak all the time. For instance, a female construction worker will speak differently on the job than she does with her friends and family. Doesn't make her a butch lesbian. Can we just talk about how the fact that everybody does this, not just gay
Everyone
men?
Everyone code switches. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. So that's what she had to say. We always welcome your comments. If you disagree with her, go to Facebook where KCRW Press Play. Weigh in.
Yeah, well, I talk in that extra that we have on Facebook about changing my voice up when I started doing the news. To sound...
That's a whole other
lower
thing.
...lower, to sound more authoritative. Anyway, that is there. KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers, thank you very much. Warren Olney with his deep baritone is next on KCRW, so keep it right here. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.